Tonight on Dateline.
When you think you've seen it all, you see this. Sex, lies, and murder.
A tow truck driver spots a black Mercedes SUV in an alley.
There's a white female body in the back seat.
Police knocked on the door at 9:30 the next morning. I think I fell to my knees.
And one of the neighbors said, well, I do notice men and women dressed in leather carrying whips.
This is a guy with a secret life.
I had never, never heard of such things.
It appeared to be a relationship based on mutual obsession.
There's no doubt in my mind that she knew what her husband was into.
That is kinky taste?
She knew.
Follow the twists and turns in one of the strangest stories we've ever had on Dateline.
I first met him on an adult website.
It was layer after layer after layer.
Get ready, because now everything just started spinning.
I'm Lester Holt, and this is Dateline. Here's Dennis Murphy with Sex, Lies, and Murder.
If you ever needed to be persuaded that bad things, grotesque things, can happen anywhere, then take a journey with us to Detroit in the wealthiest of suburbs.
It's sort of the Truman Show, right? It's sort of WandaVision. It is this perfect place. Nothing happens in Grosse Pointe Park.
Until one of their own in this community of old money and good taste was brutally murdered.
Who committed this crime? Why was this woman killed?
A very, very fun, high-energy person who loved life and did not deserve to die like this.
But if her death was a shock, what happened next would shake this community to its core.
And I just stopped for a second, and here in the back of my neck stood up, and I go, this guy's crazy.
Tonight, in the aftermath of the biggest crime and scandal ever to hit Grosse Pointe Park, we go inside the investigation with detectives.
We need to know the specifics, because only the person who did it would know how it happened.
It's like, there's more to the story, something's going on here, we have to keep digging.
And reveal all those dark secrets, desperately hidden, which, once exposed, would destroy a prominent family.
Sex acts were being performed in the dungeon. But the real story was about betrayal, about love, and about murder.
Most American cities have a neighborhood where the houses are bigger, the money a little older. In Detroit, it's Grosse Pointe.
It is the place that everybody wants to live. The homes are beautiful, the lawns are manicured. Everybody appears to live this perfect life.
And in this tasteful enclave of good schools, good churches, good families going back generations, Jane and Bob Becerra had made their home and raised their two children.
I love this place. How could you not?
Bob and Jane had been a couple for nearly 30 years. They'd each built their own careers. She was a marketing exec, he owned and managed properties, and they were known around Grosse Pointe for their volunteer work. To all appearances, the lives being lived in their nice suburban house weren't all that much different from what was happening in homes up and down the streets of Grosse Pointe Park and out around exclusive Lakeshore Drive. But that was before January 24th, 2012. Jane was driving her black Mercedes SUV home from her job in Detroit. Bob said they spoke on their cells.
She sounded perfectly fine. She said, I'm coming home. I'll be home in 20 minutes.
As Jane drove from downtown, Bob says he was tending to outside cleanup chores at one of his properties. When he got home, he thinks about 8 o'clock. There was no Jane in sight.
Did you see Jane's car here?
No, I didn't.
Anything in disarray?
No, I just assumed that she ran an errand. Well, as 8:30, 9 o'clock came, I started calling her, and her phone didn't answer.
2 more hours went by, and still no Jane. Bob said he was getting anxious.
Grosse Pointe Park, police and fire.
My name is Bob Becerra. My wife is not around, and she's not answering her cell phone, and her car and her purse and her are gone, and I'm just a little concerned.
Police tried to get in touch with Jane.
Hello, this is Jane Becerra. I am not available to take your call.
No answer, so the dispatcher left her a voicemail.
Hi, this is the Grosse Pointe Park Police. We're trying to find out where you are, ma'am. Your husband's very worried.
Bob was also working the phones.
I called my kids to say, hey, have you talked to your mother? And I called some of her friends to say, have you seen Jane? Or maybe she got together with a wine or something to share with her friends.
But it seemed no one had seen or heard from Jane since earlier that evening. Bob phoned the police again.
Yeah, hi, this is Bob Bechera calling back.
Yes, sir.
Okay, I've still not heard from her. She's not shown up. I mean, this is way out of the norm for her, so I'm very concerned.
Grosse Pointe Park police sent over an officer to collect information.
So, do you get any sleep that night?
Oh, no, I stayed up the whole night.
The next morning, a Wednesday, Grosse Pointe Park Detective Mike Narduzzi was just starting his shift.
I walk into work about 7:20, and immediately I have a missing persons report on my desk. Jane Bechera is missing.
That same morning, tow truck operators in the east end of Detroit were making their early rounds.
They would sort of look for stolen cars or abandoned cars, you know, to hustle and make some extra money before starting their shift.
Many of the homes are abandoned.
Mark Santia, at the time, was a top investigative reporter on the police beat for NBC's Detroit affiliate, WDIV.
A tow truck driver spots a black Mercedes SUV in an alley. And that black SUV stood out. Why is it in an alley? It's kind of a desolate area. So could be stolen, could be abandoned.
A shiny vehicle that wouldn't turn ahead in Grosse Pointe was like a flashing neon sign saying something's wrong here in Detroit's gritty East End. Just abandoned in this grungy alley. No sounds from within. Detective Narduzzi's phone started ringing.
I get a phone call. Are we looking for a Jane Bechera? Because we just found a Mercedes-Benz registered to her. And the whole story and case starts right from there.
When we come back, what was Jane's car doing so far from home? And where was Jane?
The contents of her purse were dumped out.
Was it robbery or was it something much worse?
So when do you get the call?
Police knocked on the door at 9:30 the next morning. I think I fell to my knees.
Jane Bechera, a dedicated wife, mother, and community volunteer, was missing. And now there were reports that her black Mercedes SUV was located in an alley in Detroit's east side. Grosse Pointe Park Detective Mike Narduzzi met Detroit investigators at the scene.
It's a pretty run-down neighborhood, a lot of vacant homes. In the alley, there's a lot of litter, garbage.
Is that an unlikely spot to find a nice, expensive car like that? Ditched, abandoned?
Yes, I would think so. It was a rough part of town.
Drug activities there?
Drug activity, sure.
At first glance, detectives noticed something on the exterior of the SUV.
It was dirty, like a winter car normally is, and on the driver's side door, the dirt was all disturbed, like freshly disturbed, like someone had leaned up against it or rolled against it.
Inside the vehicle, Detective Narduzzi could see Jane's belongings were in disarray, and on the seat, a bottle of prescription pills.
The contents of her purse were dumped out on the passenger side floorboard.
And there, crumpled over in the back seat, Detective Narduzzi saw Jane Bechera's lifeless body.
You could see heavy bruising on the left side of her face and her neck. It was all bruised up in purple, and there was a lot of trauma and injury.
This woman from Grosse Pointe in a nice Mercedes SUV. What is a woman like this doing in a vehicle like this in East Detroit, which was going through a bad part of its history?
A heroin epidemic was raging through Metro Detroit at that time. And so a lot of people would go to the east side to buy heroin.
Could that have something to do with her death? While a team of investigators worked the crime scene and tried to figure out what she'd been doing there, another team had to deliver the awful news to Bob.
So when do you get the call?
The police knocked on the door at 9:30 the next morning. I think I fell to my knees. It was absolutely the worst news I could have gotten. At that point, I just was grieving. I had to make phone calls, dreaded phone calls to my children to tell to tell them about their mother.
Soon, it was all over the news.
The 56-year-old mother found dead inside her SUV on Detroit's east side.
Grosse Pointe Park residents were shaken. It just didn't make sense. Jane and Bob Becerra were not only well-known, they were well-liked. Bob, Big Bob as he was known around Grosse Pointe, with the vanity plates to prove it, was active in Rotary, a past president, and hands-on for almost any community fundraiser you could name. Jane was a mainstay in the high school mothers group and regularly volunteered at her church.
So how did you meet Jane?
A good friend of mine in high school married her best friend, and they introduced us, and we started dating, and we clicked pretty much right away. And within 2 years, I asked her to marry me, and she said yes.
Bob says he loved that Jane didn't hold anything back.
You know, she was outgoing, a go-getter, yet she was very loving and kind, and I just was attracted to her right from the beginning because she had a good heart.
The children came along. First Robert, then Jessica.
This is where the kids grew up.
And in the front yard of their gracious home, there were two towering evergreens. Bob said he could see his children in them.
When my son was one, I bought a live Christmas tree, brought it in, we decorated it, and then undecorated it, took it outside, and they did the same for my daughter. Now they're about 30 feet, and they're wonderful.
Bob Becerra, the son of a judge, was a real estate guy. He'd buy and sell commercial and residential properties around Detroit and take in cash flow as a landlord. He bought his first property as a teenager and never looked back.
When you play the game Monopoly, the person with the most property wins.
Jane Becerra was a six-figure marketing executive who'd retired, but went back to work after an economic downturn took a toll on her husband's property business. But she was rarely too busy to miss a night of playing cards with a couple's friend of many years, Kim Tower.
Strong person, very delightful person. Her laugh would set a room on just on fire.
And she was an excellent hostess. Kim can remember dropping in unannounced.
You would think that she had planned for weeks that people were going to come over. Just wait a minute, and the food would be out. She would welcome you with open arms.
But now, her friend Jane was gone.
How do you absorb that?
I don't know. I still don't know that I have. I'm not sure the community has.
As Jane's loved ones grieved, the investigation was ramping up. Detectives wanted to talk to those closest to Jane, starting with Bob.
Coming up.
The police walked the house with me. Nothing looked like it was amiss.
Maybe Bob Becerra had nothing to hide. Maybe his wife did.
I'm not going to narc on my poor wife, but she did smoke marijuana.
Okay.
Maybe she went to buy something and...
Exactly.
When Dateline continues.
Grosse Pointe Park turned out to pay its respects to Jane Becerra, a volunteer parent at the high school whose murdered body had been found that morning inside her SUV in a seedy Detroit alley. In the crowd, her husband Bob, a sudden widower.
Jane's family members and friends, they just cannot make sense of any of this.
Reporter Hank Winchester covered the candlelight vigil for NBC affiliate WDIV in Detroit.
The first time many of us saw Bob Becerra was about 10 hours after he learned his wife was dead in a Mercedes in Detroit.
Bob was publicly grieving.
It's just unthinkable that this happened to her and what she had to suffer. I am just so upset about it.
Unthinkable what a respected husband and father like Bob Becerra was going through. The man affectionately known as Big Bob around Grosse Pointe.
Bob Becerra didn't have a criminal record. You're dealing with the perfect couple.
And yet, in cases like this, for the police, the spouse is always a suspect until ruled out. Bob had already let an officer into his home to look around.
The police walked the house with me. Nothing looked like it was a muck or a miss. We just let the police do their thing.
So you want to talk to the husband in a more formal setting. When does that happen?
The detectives made an arrangement for him to come down to the station the next day for a more formal interview.
Just have a seat, Mr. Becerra, right there.
Uh-huh.
Appreciate you coming in. It's a stressful situation.
It's no idea. It's just been unbelievable.
A day after his wife's body was found, Bob said he was still in the dark, hearing only bits and pieces from reporters.
Can you tell me, was that the cause of death? Strangulation?
Well, I met with Dr. Diaz today. There was some trauma to her, obviously, that caused her death, but he is meticulously going through it again tomorrow.
Okay. People are asking me, my kids want to know, how did mom die? I have nothing to say to him.
Detectives were trying to piece together what Jane was doing the night she disappeared. Bob told them the two had plans.
We talked about doing work on taxes and then reconfirmed that I had nothing Tuesday evening and nor did she.
Bob said he told Jane he'd be home around 8 p.m. He'd spent the afternoon and early evening cleaning up one of his properties.
Because it was cold, I was working mostly outside. I would go in the Hard Luck Lounge. I think I went in there about 5:15, had a drink. And then I came back out, went back to work.
And before heading home, Bob told investigators, a friend met him for a drink.
I said, come on, I'm up at the Hard Luck working. He said, I can be there in 10, 15 minutes. I said, great. And we had a couple drinks.
Okay, he arrived around what time, sir?
About 7, 10.
Okay.
And then we stayed till 8 o'clock and we parted company and I came home.
Bob Beshear is in the police interview room. What's his demeanor?
He was very cooperative. He was pleasant. And Bob didn't shy away from an alibi question. He told him exactly where he was.
Investigators would have to check that alibi, of course, but they moved on to more personal questions. Was Bob and Jane's marriage a happy one?
I'm sure there's something out there that she's done. Probably a lot of things that, you may not know about, and vice versa, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's just one of those things about being an adult.
We know pretty much what we're doing, about each other. I know there's not a lot of secrets and a lot of things we hide.
There was one thing which Bob hesitated to mention, but thought it might be important to the investigation.
I'm not going to narc on my poor wife, but she did smoke marijuana.
Okay.
She, took a couple puffs before she went to bed, helped her sleep. I saw no trouble in it. I didn't really know where she was getting it from, but I wasn't going to question it, and I let her do her thing,
Okay, so that's another angle, which is an important angle, because...
Maybe she went to buy something, and...
Exactly. Where could she go? Now we're looking at maybe bordering dope houses where they sell weed,
Could that explain why Jane was in an East Detroit neighborhood that was known for drugs?
I appreciate you coming in and doing that for us today.
I'm happy to cooperate as much as I can.
Investigators wrapped up Bob's interview by collecting his DNA.
In the midst of all of this, do you have time to step back and say, what happened here? Why is it that my wife has been abducted, apparently, in her car and is now dead, murdered?
I had no clue. I had no understanding why someone would want to do this, I didn't know if she was abducted here or if she was out running an errand and was carjacked.
Investigators were eager to find answers to those questions too. But first, there would be many more questions about Jane and about Big Bob.
Coming up.
It seemed like the body was taken there.
A different theory of the crime and a different side of Bob Beshara.
One of the neighbors said, well, I do notice men and women dressed in leather from head to toe, but that's the only thing I noticed that could be out of the ordinary. And I'm like, out of the ordinary? Yeah.
Two days after Jane's death, the medical examiner had confirmed what investigators all but knew. Jane had died a violent and painful death.
She had died by strangulation, most likely, and most likely by hands, as there was no ligature marks, there was no puncture wounds, anything along those lines.
The medical examiner noted something else. Jane had a broken fingernail, meaning she likely fought with her killer. The fingernail was bagged and sent to the lab for DNA testing. Meanwhile, detectives took a closer look at the evidence, and it wasn't adding up. There was no sign of a struggle inside the SUV. And although Jane's purse had been dumped out, most of her valuables seemed to be there.
It didn't appear that there was a robbery gone bad because it didn't seem like anything was missing.
So a wrong time, wrong place scenario didn't really work here.
Correct. It seemed like the body was taken there.
Absent any solid leads, Bob himself suggested perhaps Jane's death could be connected to a string of similar unsolved murders in the area.
At the time, there were several homicides that were dubbed the Backpage Murders.
Mark Santia reported on them for WDIV.
These horrific cases where women would meet up with someone that they met on Backpage, an adult website, and then the women would disappear, and then they would be found in the trunk of a car dead. So now you had Jane in the back seat of this abandoned SUV. Was this the fifth victim in the Backpage Murders?
But police had a different theory, that Jane wasn't murdered in crime-ridden Detroit, but just 7 miles away in suburban Grosse Pointe Park, a city that hadn't seen a single murder in 20 years.
Here you were off on your first homicide case.
Correct. And at that time, I probably had been a detective for 2.5, 3 years.
Detective Narduzzi was working the case with help from Detroit PD. At the top of their investigative checklist was verifying Bob's alibi the night Jane disappeared. They talked to this man, Mike Mulyanis, who'd known Bob for a few years. Mike owned the Hard Luck Lounge, which was located in one of Bob's buildings.
Was he around a lot, Mike? Did you see him?
Yeah, he would just pop in. He would use his key and come in the back door while we were busy.
And the evening of Tuesday, January 24th was no different. One of Mike's employees remembered seeing Bob in and out of the bar the night Jane disappeared. And just as Bob told police, a friend joined him there for a drink.
He met with an old guy. They went around the corner and sat in the lounge part.
Though Bob's story seemed to check out, Mike told police there was something strange about that day.
He said he was out back doing work, cleaning up. Bob never did anything. He had other people do work.
Still, many people saw Bob at the bar that night, which seemed to support his alibi. But this is where the story takes the first of many unbelievable turns. You see, it wasn't just the regulars at the Hard Luck Lounge who recognized Bob. His very public grieving was making local news watchers all over Greater Detroit say, "I know that guy." And they were calling reporter Hank Winchester to tell him how.
Bob Becerra was the party man about Grosse Pointe, dinner parties, a Christmas event. But the other side of Bob Becerra, the real party side of Bob Becerra, happened behind closed doors. And we're not just talking about a casino night.
Those tips led Winchester to talk to some neighbors of the Hard Luck Lounge who'd noticed unusual comings and goings from the building's basement.
And one of the neighbors said, "Well, I do notice from time to time men and women dressed in leather from head to toe, wearing masks, carrying whips. But that's the only thing I noticed that could be out of the ordinary." And I'm like, out of the ordinary? Yeah.
In fact, Mike Mulyanis had accidentally discovered landlord Bob was up to something strange in the basement.
That's where the fuse box was for the whole place. And my contractor said, "He's got some freaky stuff down there." And I'm like, "What are you talking about?" And he's like, "He's got like harnesses and chains hanging from the ceiling."
What the contractor seemed to have discovered was a so-called dungeon for BDSM, bondage, domination, sadism, and masochism.
Witnesses have told police that Bob Becerra had a sex dungeon in the basement of a building he owned in Grosse Pointe Park.
The discovery of the dungeon immediately activated bloggers from Detroit's underground BDSM community who were firing off emails to Winchester.
People saying, "I know Bob Becerra, but I don't know Bob Becerra as Grosse Pointe Bob. I know Bob Becerra as Master Bob."
Master Bob, in this world of whips and dog collars, the stories went, was a dom or dominant. Someone who exerted total control over his sexual partners in a dungeon like this one. Investigators looking into the murder of Jane Becerra were now curious. This S&M business, based on power and control with some pain thrown in, seemed way more than the all-too-common woman-on-the-side theory of motivation.
This is a guy with a secret life. Now, did the secret life have anything to do with the death of his wife?
Coming up, behind closed doors with one of Master Bob's partners.
Next to the bed, there was a giant web-like looking device.
What?
It looked like a giant spider web with rope.
Do I want to know?
When Dateline continues.
The The people of Tony Grosse Pointe Park were trying to wrap their heads around the revelation that their friend, a neighbor, and grieving widower, Bob Becerra, had a secret kinky side. This real-life 50 Shades of Grosse Pointe had become a steamy topic.
Bob Becerra's alleged secret life.
And Becerra's interest and involvement in the S&M bondage community.
The media has painted a picture of me as a terrible person and all these different things going on in my life when they didn't know me.
But this woman, who asked that we call her Lynn, did know him.
The day that I heard the news, I went to the police right off.
She told detectives about a 2009 romp in the dungeon she said she had with a man who called himself Master Bob.
I said he was very involved in the BDSM lifestyle.
Disguised beneath theatrical makeup, Lynn agreed to talk to us about her sexual lifestyle and the person she knew as Master Bob. A single mom with a job, Lynn had made her own journey from the straight life, vanilla as she calls it, and understands the lure of being controlled and dominated.
How do you go through that door?
It's a scary door, especially for somebody, you know, later in life discovering this. The sex life, it was pretty boring to me.
Conventional,
always
we're talking.
Conventional. Right? Vanilla. Yeah. So I stumbled upon it, and it kind of hit me. I'm like, well, this is what I've been missing.
You're a submissive.
Yes. Submissive means you submit to that dominant. So the submissive will do pretty much anything her dominant says.
Lynn said dungeon parties can be held just about anywhere, in warehouses, rental halls, garages, even suburban rec rooms. Invitations come through the web and word of mouth.
What about that? You're invited to a dungeon party? How do you know you're not going to John Wayne Gacy's?
Yeah, you don't. You don't. With me personally, I talk to people for a while. If there's anything that doesn't sound right, I wouldn't go.
She said she heard about the dungeon beneath a bar from Becerra himself, and that he found her on an alternative lifestyle website.
And the reason I followed through was because I had not experienced a dungeon. And so understanding the draw and the excitement, I had to see the dungeon.
So one afternoon, Lynn said she met Master Bob and another woman, Bob's submissive sex companion, at the Hard Luck Lounge. She said the three of them spent a few minutes at the bar, chatted about nothing in particular, and relaxed with a few stiff drinks.
And then down to the dungeon. The first thing I see in the far corner is a bed. Next to the bed, there was a giant, giant web-like looking device.
What?
It looked like a giant spider web with rope.
Do I want to know?
It was a 360 type web.
The spider web contraption was in storage when the local camera crew was filming undercover. But the grungy, windowless dungeon contained the hooks, ropes, and other toys Lynn remembered. She, Bob, and the other woman got down to business.
How do you break the ice?
Oh, that was quick because she disrobed as soon as we got there and already had her collar on, and that's what I was ordered to do, and that's what I did.
And Master Bob is telling you what to do.
Yes.
And you're having a great time.
Yep. And that's where we initially both had our first flogging.
Lynn, you say that so easily. My first flogging in the dungeon.
Yeah.
Yet she says she never went back to Master Bob's dungeon. She liked the other woman well enough, but Master Bob?
Self-absorbed, very, very dominant.
She went to the police, she said, because she believed Bob's secret life might be relevant.
The whole purpose of this is justice for Jane's murder.
Do you feel like there's a time coming when you need to put your story out and say, okay, well, the rest of you may not understand this alternative lifestyle.
Mm-hmm.
Here's what you don't know. Here's how I fit into that.
Dennis, I have a number of people that I will share the truth with. But the number one thing I need to do is get past this.
But after talking to Lynn and others, investigators were less interested in the lurid details of Bob's secret sex life. There appeared to be a much more conventional issue, creating chaos in his marriage to Jane.
We had been hearing that Bob may have had a girlfriend.
It would turn out that other woman in the dungeon with Master Bob and Lynn wasn't all that submissive. In fact, it was she who had begun to dominate Bob's life.
Coming up, a betrayal.
And he'd lie to me.
And a confession.
This thing threatened my life personally. If I didn't do it, I was a dead man.
Investigators hunting Jane Bashara's killer had become interested in her husband's most frequent BDSM partner. Her name was Rachel Gillette. The 50-year-old divorced single mother worked as a secretary at Wayne State University. She and Bob Bashara met on an alternative lifestyle website. Rachel lived for a short time just above the Hard Luck Lounge and Master Bob's sex dungeon. The bar's owner, Mike Mouyanis, would occasionally see her and Bob together.
He would introduce her as his tenant. And he would say, oh, I was fixing something in one of my tenants' apartments when we would see him come down the stairs.
Rachel was now thrust into the middle of a very public investigation. Detective Narduzzi sat down with her.
She said they had gone to these BDSM parties.
But it was more than just a sexual relationship. According to Rachel, she and Bob had been dating for more than 3 years. Bob even traveled to South Carolina for her daughter's wedding in 2011. This shot of them dancing was posted on the photo company's Facebook page. It became clear to investigators there was something potentially explosive about this relationship.
Bob had this obsession with Rachel. It appeared to be a relationship based on mutual obsession.
But with the whole scandalous affair now out in the open, and Bob publicly grieving about his wife, Rachel went on the offensive to tell her side of the story to WDIV reporter Mark Santia.
Rachel, you turn on the television. Bob's on the TV, he's crying, and he's talking about losing his soulmate, his wife. What went through your mind?
Well, obviously, first of all, that he was still married, that the divorce that I thought had happened in May didn't happen, and that he'd lied to me, and I went in shock, pretty much.
With the revelations about his secret sex life, Bob Bashara was officially named a person of interest in the case.
Jane's husband has been called the only person of interest.
But Bashara had his own person of interest he wanted the police to look at.
Bob's lawyer hand delivers a letter to the Grosse Pointe Park Police Department naming Joe Gentz.
Here's a guy you should look at, huh?
Correct.
So Detective Narduzzi brought in this Joe Gentz.
It was real obvious something was going on with this guy.
Gentz, a massive man with a child's IQ, denied having anything to do with the murder. But while the 48-year-old told detectives nothing, his body language said he had something to hide.
He gets all flustered and loud and gregarious, and he's upset, and he's kind of pacing around the interview room, and eventually he says he wants to leave.
Which he did. He was yet another strange and puzzling character who had entered the case, and Narduzzi didn't know what to make of him.
How did this guy know Bashara in the first place?
They were introduced by Steve Tabato in approximately September of 2011.
Tabato owned an appliance and furniture store.
Bob stumbled into my place one day, probably 10 years prior to 2011.
Over the years, Bashara bought appliances from Tabato for his rental properties. Joe Gentz had worked for Tabato in the past.
Joe's got a good heart. He's very boisterous. And he has the mentality of a very young person.
Tabato asked Bashara for a favor. Help Gentz find an apartment. Bashara did and also hired Gentz to work odd jobs at his rental properties and own home. So why was Bashara suggesting police look at Gentz? Before anyone could figure that out, Gentz was back, turning himself in just hours later and spilling his guts in a police interview room about a job Bashara had asked him to do.
He says, well, I got something going on, and he says, I need to take care of it. He says, well, my wife dead.
Did you believe him?
I didn't believe him at first.
Okay.
But Gentz told detectives that Bashara was persistent, then threatening.
I turned him down the first time. And I said, no way. And he got mad. He come up to me again. I said, no way. This time he threatened my life. Personally, if I didn't do it, I was a dead man.
Gentz spoke to the police over a period of 2 days. At times, the 6'4" Hulk lashed out in anger.
I ain't no way to crap!
But in a barely audible voice, he seemed to confess.
I did it.
Okay. I'll say it again.
I did it.
Okay.
And ultimately, he recounted to detectives in vivid detail what he said happened the night Jane Becerra was murdered.
So what time do you think you got to his house Tuesday night?
Doctor, at 7.
7 o'clock, okay.
Gentz said Becerra let him into the garage, where they waited under the guise of moving boxes. When Jane entered the garage, Gentz said she started arguing with her husband.
Then what happened?
Then Bob turns around and says, take care of it. I looked at him, and I'm like this, and that's when he pulled out the gun.
Gentz said Becerra pointed the gun at him. The implication was clear.
No matter which way you look at it, I'm a dead man, too.
What? Did she see the gun?
Did he tell you about killing Jane?
Yep, he said he killed Jane.
Where did you hit her?
Back on the nut.
Okay.
To get her down on the ground.
Okay, go on.
Anyways, grabbed her. Like this. And Bob says, take her out. She out. He kept on yelling at me.
Gentz told detectives he put his boot on Jane's neck to finish the job.
Did she stop moving?
Her neck's broke.
Okay.
Why do you think the neck is broken? Did you hear something crack?
I heard it crack. Okay. Joe, sit down.
You want some water?
Gentz said he and Becerra loaded Jane's body into her SUV, and then Gentz drove it to East Detroit, where he ditched it in that alley. But if Becerra had gotten his wife out of the picture that way, what was in it for Gentz?
How much was he supposed to pay you?
Eight.
$8,000?
Plus a candy.
$8,000 and a used Cadillac. The price Jane's life was worth to her husband. Joe Gentz's detailed confession had seemingly given detectives everything they needed to charge him and the man he implicated with Jane's murder. And yet, 72 hours after he walked into the Grosse Pointe Park police station, Joe Gentz walked right back out.
Just when you think you know the Bob Becerra case, here comes another twist. Here comes someone who walks in off the street and says, I did it. And then they're released. But that's just the beginning.
Coming up.
So you detectives are saying, do we believe this guy?
We got to corroborate him.
And with just a little checking, a trail that leads right to Bob Becerra.
He called him 10 times by 9:30 in the morning, the day before the murder.
When Dateline continues.
It had been a whirlwind 3 days in the Jane Becerra murder investigation. Police had interviewed, detained, and then released a man who said he killed her.
Here it is, the exclusive new footage of the man we've called Joe going free.
Authorities could not legally hold the uncharged Gentz after 72 hours, so they cut him loose. And investigators wondered if they could trust the startling and detailed confession of a man with a clearly diminished mental capacity.
So you detectives are saying, do we believe this guy? Is he telling us the truth, this awful story? You got to corroborate it.
We got to corroborate it.
The easily manipulated Gentz had said he alone killed Jane, but that he was acting on orders from Bob Becerra. Detectives needed to prove that, so they examined the two men's phone records.
Between Joe and Bob, from September to January 27, there was a lot of phone calls.
472 phone calls, to be exact. On the day before Jane's murder, Becerra called Gentz 22 times.
Including his first call of the day, he called him 10 times by 9:30 in the morning, the day before the murder. The day of the murder, the first call he makes is to Joe.
Could the calls be dismissed as the day-to-day business chatter between a landlord and his handyman? Not according to Gentz, who had painted a picture in his police interview of an increasingly desperate Bob Becerra in the days leading up to Jane's death. Something big was coming, Gentz claimed Becerra told him, and Becerra needed Jane out of the way before whatever it was got there.
He says, the deadline, whatever the deadline is. I gotta get this done, and it's big. Whatever it is, it was big.
What was the deadline Bob was allegedly facing? Reporter Mark Santia thought he knew. His interview with Bob's girlfriend, Rachel, was the key.
Rachel said, I had enough. I was fed up. For 3 years, he's telling me, I'm a widow, I'm getting a divorce, I am divorced. She's like, finally, you have a deadline. That's it. And I said, what did you say to him? She said, I told him there's a deadline. And I immediately thought of Joe Gentz in that garage.
This is that word again. Everybody's got a deadline in this thing. What was her deadline?
Rachel didn't want to live in the land of make-believe. Do we have a relationship here, or do we not have a relationship here?
Rachel told detectives the same thing.
Rachel gave Bob an ultimatum that weekend prior to the homicide. She told him, I need to see your divorce papers now.
Rachel's ultimatum seemed to explain why Bob needed Jane out of the way. But investigators still needed physical evidence from the murder itself. So they went back to Joe Gentz's confession.
Everything happened on that driver's side of the vehicle. There was nothing on the passenger side whatsoever.
In the driver's side door, the dirt was all disturbed, as if someone brushed up against it or there was a struggle or something.
Gentz also described what was left inside the vehicle in addition to Jane's body, a description that exactly matched what investigators found.
Where'd you leave the keys?
On the floor.
Did Jane have any personal effects of hers? Wallet, ID, purse, anything like that?
Yep.
Okay, where was that at?
Bob threw it in there.
Threw it in where?
In the vehicle.
Where at in the vehicle?
On the floor.
Front, back?
Front.
Gentz told investigators that after dumping the SUV, he went to a nearby McDonald's to get something to eat. Police found security camera footage of him doing exactly that.
So his story is checking out.
Over the course of weeks, we were able to corroborate it.
And in a major coup, investigators were able to recover forensic evidence tying Gentz directly to the murder.
He told us that he was wearing these boots and that he got rid of the boots. And he told us that he dropped these boots into a clothing donation box.
Detective Narduzzi says they tracked down the boots and sent them off to the lab for testing.
Her DNA was on the bottom of those boots.
So his story's corroborated on a major point right there.
Yes.
But the boot wasn't the only source of DNA evidence. Gentz told investigators that Jane fought for her life during their struggle and showed the cops the scratches to prove it.
So she got you there?
She got me by the neck.
Okay.
There you go.
Okay.
There's the DNA.
And the victim had a broken fingernail and there was traces of Joe Gentz there. Huh?
Correct.
After nearly a month-long investigation to corroborate Gentz's confession, authorities finally felt they had enough to make a move, but only on Gentz.
Joe was supposed to have a hearing for an unrelated matter with his daughter. We were there, we were talking to Joe, and we had no idea.
Santia's cameraman was rolling as Gentz was ushered into a conference room by a cadre of officers.
You're under arrest for the murder of Amos.
Joe Gentz was now in custody. But Bob Becerra, the man Gentz claimed hired him to do the job, was not.
You really believe that the husband's got his fingerprints on this thing?
Yes.
That he's the architect of the crime, right?
Yes,
so
absolutely.
You're going to get to the husband via Joe, I think, right? Is that the strategy?
At that point, we believe, Joe, that Bob did this.
Bob Becerra would have a lot to say about that.
Coming up, a cold-blooded killer or a heartbroken husband?
Did you murder your wife? Did you cause her death?
Joe Gentz, the handyman, was behind bars.
I did.
In his confession, he'd said that Jane's husband, his sometime boss Bob Becerra, pulled a gun on him that night and ordered him to murder the wife or be killed himself. But if that was the case, why hadn't Becerra himself been arrested for murder yet?
The police chief comes out and says, there's one person of interest, Bob Becerra. What had happened there?
I have no idea. I mean, they have a man that admitted to killing her, this Joe Gentz. I was the one that referred Joe to them 2 days after Jane's death.
And yet, before anybody hears about Joe, the handyman, they're hearing about you.
Right. Terrible.
The person of interest.
Person of interest. And from that point on, the media has ruined my life. The most important thing, though, is I've lost my wife. The number one most important thing. And I have children that have lost their mother. And that's what everyone seems to forget in this whole mess.
Did you murder your wife? Did you cause her death?
Absolutely not.
Were you in cahoots with this handyman guy?
No.
Are you kidding? Come in and do the dirty work?
Oh, no, absolutely not. Let me tell you something. I loved my wife dearly. Loved my wife.
It was Gentz and Gentz alone, said Becerra, Case closed.
All I know is that he's admitted doing this. They have the man behind bars. Let me rebuild my life. Let me move on. I miss her terribly. The mother of two wonderful children is gone. And that just absolutely saddens me.
Bashara said his big mistake was being a soft touch for Gantz, trying to throw some work his way. The handyman, he said, was in and out of family court at the time and desperate for money.
He called me incessantly, needed to talk, needed money, because he had a custody hearing where he needed $1,500 to pay a lawyer, and I wouldn't give it to him.
He tells the story that you're there in the garage with a gun on him. He's saying, do it now.
Unbelievable that he would even say that. The man is a disturbed man, and he made a mistake. And he crossed the line, killed my wife, and now he's trying to blame it on me.
And said he did it for what, a little $1,000 or so in an old beat-up Cadillac?
First of all, he said $2,000. Yeah. Then it was $6,000. Then it was $8,000 in a Cadillac. I didn't offer him anything to do anything. Think about it just for a moment. If you wanted to harm someone, would you hire a guy with a 68 IQ and have the work done in your garage, in your home? Just for a moment, think about that. Does that make any sense? Absolutely not. I mean, I'm not a nefarious person, but I'm certainly not going to hire an idiot to kill my wife in my garage.
And the idea that he forced Gantz to do it at gunpoint was preposterous, said Bashara.
I'm not a violent man. I'm a pacifist, actually. I don't own a gun.
Police found no evidence of a gun registered to Bashara, and no firearms were found in the Bashara home. While Bashara scoffed at Gantz's confession implicating him, he acknowledged there was truth to the rumors circulating around town.
Were there other women?
I do not want to get into a lot of this because of my children, but I will tell you that I did have... I have a relationship with one other woman.
Is this the woman known as Rachel?
Yes. But it has nothing to do with this case or anything to do with the death of Jane. Nothing at all.
He also said, without providing specifics, that his wife was aware of the other woman in his life.
Jane and I had a very good relationship. We had understandings on certain things.
Would you say it's what they used to call an open marriage in the 70s?
Well, I don't want to go that far, but it was a little bit like that, yes.
It was some sort of an understanding.
We had an understanding, correct. And that's what people are going to find hard to believe, her family, her friends.
Jane's family declined Dateline's interview requests. But 2 months before our interview with Bob Bashara in 2012, they issued a statement rejecting any claims of an open marriage. We as a family are certain that Jane would have chosen to end her marriage rather than participate in an open marriage. Any comments made to the contrary should be met with disbelief.
Did Jane know about the alternative lifestyle?
No. You try to keep things private, not to embarrass anyone.
Bob, this really gets complicated by what's being called your alternative lifestyle and people who say they know a different Bob Bashara. They know Master Bob.
Well, you know,
what do you say about it all?
Let me tell you, it was a private part of my life. It was nothing. It had nothing to do with Jane. And people talk about that dark side. They don't even know about what's involved with that. They think of this terrible notion of different things, but they don't know. They don't know what was going on.
Forget his lifestyle, Bashara said. It was irrelevant. The only thing that mattered was that Joe Gantz had confessed to killing Jane.
So this is end of case, as you see it.
I would hope so. Let me rebuild my life. My life's been torn apart. Every aspect of it. I've lost my job. I've taken a leave of absence from Rotary. It's unbelievable.
Unbelievable. That's what you could say about what happened next. Because a case that was already sad and strange was about to go completely off the rails.
You thought the Bashara case was askew? You thought the Bashara case was strange? Get ready, because now everything just started spinning.
Coming up, Murder for Hire, Take 2.
How much you talk?
20.
Okay. cash. No check.
With a cast right out of a mob movie.
So what was the role you had to play at that point? Tough guy?
A little bit of Goodfellas with Robert De Niro, because he wanted to kill everybody in that movie, and he did kill half of them, you know what I mean?
When Dateline continues. Just over a month after Jane Becerra's murder, her husband's one-time handyman, Joe Gentz, was behind bars. Investigators kept talking to other people in Bob Becerra's orbit, which brings us to a new wild chapter in our story. It involves Steve Tabato, that furniture salesman who introduced Bob to Gentz.
The police were interested in what you had to say, huh?
Well, yeah. I really believe they thought I was the guy who orchestrated the whole deal.
Did that make you a little scared?
Well, yeah, but I told them. I kept on telling them if I would have orchestrated a deal, you would have never found the body. You know what I mean?
Tabato told police that a few weeks after Jane's murder and Gentz's arrest, Bob asked him to come over to his house to look at a refrigerator that wasn't working.
Next thing, he starts bleeding in my ear about how he needs Joe Gentz taken care of.
So it's not about refrigerators at all?
No, it's about silencing Joe.
So he's got to have Gentz killed?
Yeah, more or less. He was asking me if I could reach out and touch him.
Hearing this story, investigators decided to wire up Tabato to record Bob, hoping he would implicate himself in trying to have Gentz killed in jail. Special Agent Chris Hess with the FBI in Detroit was assigned to work with Tabato on the operation. Where is it agreed that Tabato was going to meet Becerra?
So the meetings were to take place at Tabato's shop, at his store in Detroit.
You're the coach of this thing. What's your last word to him as you send him out to play?
My last word to him is be yourself. You know him, you know how to interact with him.
An FBI surveillance team had Bob in their sights as he arrived to meet Tabato.
Comes to my store, and he looked really terrible, like he hadn't been sleeping.
Though it's hard to make out, one of the first things Bob told Tabato was that he didn't kill his wife.
I've been at some things, okay? Skins either acted wrongly or had someone else help him, but not me. All of them want something wrong. There's no reason for that. She was making 125 a year. Her and I got along for over.
Then Bob cut to the chase, saying he could pay Tabato $20,000 if he would find a hitman in jail who could get rid of Joe Gentz.
How much you talk?
20.
Cash. No checks.
Yeah.
Give me 10 up front. If it doesn't go down, I'll give you the money back.
Gotta be done ahead of time.
Bob sounded determined, but also nervous about trusting Tabato.
Oh, get the f*** out of here, man. What'd you say? Hey, what do they got to wire?
Did he pat you down looking for the device?
Oh, yeah. I strip searched for him.
What'd you tell him?
I says, I bent over and mooned him. I says, you see any wires over there? I said, I'm wireless.
He was wired, of course. The FBI had cleverly disguised its device. The two kept talking. Tabato spun out some creative ideas about how someone could get rid of Joe Gentz in that jail.
Yeah, I think I can get somebody to go in there. He'll go in there.
Yeah.
He'll go get locked up in there. I mean, he'll put glass in the sugar or salt, and he'll eat glass. It'll tear up his whole insides. He'll drop dead in 2 days.
Yeah. Whatever. Look at you. Whatever.
Just get your money together.
So what was the role you had to play at that point? Tough guy?
I figured I'd focus on movie actors that I've seen.
So a little bit of Goodfellas, a little bit of Godfather?
A little bit of Goodfellas with Robert De Niro, because he wanted to kill everybody in that movie, and he did kill half of them, you know what I mean?
So when you're doing this face-to-face, how's he behaving, Steve?
Like a nut is on drugs.
He's rattled? He's agitated?
And then a couple days later, he's calm. He's a chameleon.
Tabato says it was that calmer Bob who showed up 3 days later at his furniture shop, cash in hand, and whispering.
Just yes or no. Do you think you can do this? Just yes or no. 80%, 90%?
Yes.
On the FBI recording, you can even hear Bob doling out the down payment.
Here's two.
Becerra pays him $2,000 in cash and asks for a receipt.
A receipt? A receipt for commissioning the hit?
Well, a receipt for appliances to cover his commissioning of a hit.
Is that weird? Did you ask for a receipt in a cash deal?
I would say it's weird, yes.
With that transaction on tape, the FBI had the goods. Minutes after that meeting with Tabato, police swooped in to arrest Bob.
Only defender cameras roll as Bob Becerra leaves the police station in the back of a squad car.
It's not where you expected this thing to go.
It is not what we expected at all. We were stunned. But then with this case, you just never really knew what was coming next.
Wayne County prosecutors charged Bob Becerra with solicitation to murder Joe Gentz. Realizing he was caught on tape, Bob decided not to fight it and pleaded guilty. In court, he tearfully admitted to the murder-for-hire plot, but never said why he wanted to kill Gentz.
I am truly and humbly sorry for my actions. I apologize to this court. I apologize to Mr. Gentz.
He was sentenced to prison for nearly 7 years. Then, just 10 days later, Joe Gentz was in court to plead guilty too. But he cut a deal with prosecutors, pleading to second-degree murder in Jane's death and given a lesser sentence. In exchange, he agreed to testify against Bob.
Bob Becerra offered me money to kill his wife. He threatened me if I didn't kill her.
The prosecution now had its star witness. And with Bob behind bars, investigators had enough to finally charge the husband with Jane's murder. The day came more than a year after her death.
Today, Robert Becerra has been charged with one count of first-degree premeditated murder.
To that and to other charges, including conspiracy and solicitation to commit murder, Bob pleaded not guilty, setting the stage for a roller coaster of a trial.
Coming up, a case that surprised even the judge.
When you think you've seen it all, you see this.
And Dateline is a star witness.
On Dateline, he said they had an open marriage, and that upset me.
By October 2014, more than 2.5 years after Jane Becerra's death, her husband, Big Bob to some, Master Bob to others, was now just Defendant Bob, preparing to face trial for her murder. By then, he was a pariah to his one-time defenders in Grosse Pointe, including his own son and daughter, who were set to testify against him. Mark Santia had moved on to report for WNBC-TV in New York, but followed the trial closely from afar.
Bob became an outcast. People did not want to be associated with Bob at all, because people could see where this was going.
In the case Tuesday morning,
Hank Winchester sat in court every day as the case unfolded.
People in Detroit, the surrounding areas, Grosse Pointe, they wanted to see how this was going to play out. And trust me, it did not disappoint. This trial was just about as wild as the investigation itself.
Judge Vonda Evans, who has since retired from the bench, presided over the case.
In your years on the bench, had you ever encountered a case like that of Bob Becerra?
When you think you've seen it all, you see this. It was everything that made cases interesting. Sex, lies, and murder.
Wow, Mr. Becerra, you looking good today.
Good morning, Your Honor.
How are you?
Thank you.
Your Honor, what did you make of when you saw him in court for the first time? Big guy.
Very large man, but very gentle. It was hard to reconcile the allegations against him looking at him.
Prosecutors, of course, believed that Bob was far from gentle. With no forensics to link him to that murder scene in the garage, their chief strategy was to attack his character with a parade of witnesses who had many stories to tell about Master Bob.
The goal here was to tear down the facade, tear down the idea that this was a successful man in Grosse Pointe with a great family who lived a perfect life. How? Well, they exposed Bob's secret life.
The cast of characters testifying for the prosecution included several men and women from around Detroit who had been with Bob at parties and in that dungeon beneath the Hardlock Lounge, sparking curiosity from the judge.
What is the BDSM?
It's a good question. I was just involved. Bob introduced me to it. It's
what
part.
Is it? I mean, you know, in order to introduce you to something, you got to know what it is.
It's very hard to explain.
Apart from the salacious details, prosecutors were determined to zero in on one particular person in Bob's life, Rachel Gillette, Bob's girlfriend.
I first met him on an adult website.
On the stand, Rachel testified about their first connection online.
I was single, a submissive woman looking for a dominant single man.
She said their initial contact was all based on a lie.
And what does he tell you in person after you've spoken to him online about his marital status?
That he was a widower.
Did she think she was in love with Bob, or do you think he was in love with her?
I think Rachel bought into the whole deal. She thought that she was beginning this new life with Bob. And it seems like, you know, she was just completely blindsided by the whole thing herself, if that's what you believe from her testimony.
And while Rachel appeared to be the other woman in Bob's life, jurors would hear that he actually had another other woman in his plans.
We had talked off and on about having another woman either live with us or have a relationship with him.
Okay. And when you say another person live with you, you're talking about living in the house that you two were buying for together.
Yeah. Yes.
You heard it right. A house. Prosecutors showed that in the months before Jane's death, Bob and Rachel were looking at real estate in Grosse Pointe to build their new life together. In fact, they had a closing date set for this house. With all that talk from Rachel and from Gents about a deadline, here was a literal one. January 27th, 3 days after Jane's murder. And the hope was that their arrangement in that new home would also include this woman, Janet Lehman. Bob met her online, hoping to recruit her and bring her to Grosse Pointe to live with him and Rachel.
Well, yes, he told me he was looking for a third, and I told him that I didn't want to be a third wheel and that I was looking for a one-on-one, and then he contacted me back and said no, it wouldn't be like that.
She said Bob was persistent, and 2 weeks before Jane's murder, he traveled to Oregon to spend a weekend with Janet and test the waters.
At some point when you were together during this weekend, did you begin to have intimate relations?
Yes.
But she testified that the sex with Bob was very rough, and it convinced her to send Bob packing. Before he left, she said, she overheard him on the phone in a confrontational conversation that stuck with her.
And he said, I want this done. I want this done now.
Yeah, and I want it done before I get back.
And he said he wanted it done before he got back.
Yes.
Prosecutors believe that person he was talking to was Joe Gents, and what Bob wanted was for Jane to be murdered.
Why all this urgency? The guy on the phone, you got to do it now.
He's going to lose Rachel. And she has said to him, listen, the clock is ticking. If we're going to be together, we have to do this quickly.
Prosecutors noted that on the day before his wife's murder, Bob was constantly calling Joe Gents. That series of 22 calls in total.
He was clearly at a point where he was melting down, working to get in touch with Joe Gents. If you think Joe Gents, Bob, is a crazy guy and you want no interaction with him in your life, why in the world are you calling him dozens of times a day? It doesn't add up.
Bob's cell phone helped tell another story, too. FBI Special Agent Chris Hess analyzed cell phone tower evidence for Bob's phone and testified about his findings.
So on the day that Jane is murdered, Bashara's alibi is he's at that bar and he doesn't get back home until much later. He says, I'm not in the garage with Gents. What's the story told by his telephone?
The phone associated with Bashara tells a completely different story. He was at one point at the Hardlock Lounge. However, there was a point in time where he does leave the lounge and he's in the area consistent with their house.
He's not at the Hardlock Lounge the way he says.
Correct.
With that, prosecutors believe they shot a hole clean through Bob's alibi. And while prosecutors put more than 70 witnesses on the stand, they believed in some ways the most damaging witness against Big Bob Ashera was the man himself, in his numerous statements in the media. The state played clips from the interview with Bob that Dateline broadcast in 2012, including Bob's description of his marriage to Jane.
There was some sort of an understanding.
We had an understanding, correct.
Jane's mom took the stand to express her anger at her son-in-law.
On Dateline, he said they had an open marriage, and that upset me.
Back in 2012, Bob had also told us about his initial reaction to the news of Jane's death. Prosecutors played the clip in court.
So when do you get the call?
The police knocked on the door at 9:30 the next morning. I think I fell to my knees. It was absolutely the worst news I could have gotten.
The detective who met Bob that morning took the stand and said that description was a lie. Like some other witnesses, he opted not to have his face appear on camera.
There wasn't really a lot of reaction.
Reaction or emotion?
Both.
And prosecutors had one more clip to play the jury. Joe Gentz had claimed that Bob pointed a gun at him in that garage, threatening him if he didn't kill Jane. Bob told us that was untrue, and it was this simple.
I'm not a violent man. I'm a pacifist, actually. I don't own a gun.
But Bob's mother took the stand and said that 5 months after Jane's death, she'd gone to Bob's safety deposit box and discovered something.
I found a gun.
Had you ever seen that gun before?
No.
Bob's mother contacted his attorney at the time, David Grimm, who held onto the gun for 14 months before finally turning it over to investigators.
Clearly, Bob had a gun. Now, whether it was held to Joe Gentz's head within the garage that night, well, that's now up for the jury to try to put that piece of the puzzle together.
For prosecutors, it all told a story of a man lying through his teeth to anyone who would listen, all to cover up his plan to kill Jane and begin a new life with his girlfriend, Rachel.
What they did was, it was like almost unfolding an onion. It was a layer after layer after layer until you finally got to the core.
Except one big layer was missing from the prosecution's case. Their star witness, Joe Gentz. And Bob's defense would have a lot to say about that.
Coming up, maybe Master Bob's sex life wasn't so secret.
There's no doubt in my mind that she knew what her husband was into.
Jane Bashera knew.
She knew.
About his kinky taste?
She knew.
When Dateline continues.
Bob Bashira's one-time handyman, Joe Gentz, had pleaded guilty to strangling and killing Jane, but struck a plea deal with prosecutors to cooperate with them. Gentz was expected to testify that Bob threatened at gunpoint to kill him if he didn't murder Jane. But when Gentz came into court, he had a surprise for everyone.
Is your desire at this time not to testify for either party?
No, ma'am.
Bob, who was serving a prison sentence for trying to order a hit on Gentz, sat in court stunned.
Everyone is expecting Joe Gentz to tell his story of killing Jane and all the lurid details. And then what? Lo and behold, he elects not to testify, which I think is contravening his deal he's cut with the prosecutors.
But at the end of the day, so many people wanted to hear directly from Joe. What happened in that garage? How was this all set up, Joe? Is Bob really the mastermind of it all?
Prosecutors didn't contest Gentz's decision not to testify, believing they had a strong enough case without him. But Lillian Diallo, one of Bob Bashira's two defense attorneys at trial, had been eager to cross-examine Gentz.
I was so unhappy that I couldn't put this man on the witness stand.
Diallo regarded Gentz as an unreliable witness who told multiple versions of his story. What's more, when he was first interviewed by investigators, she says he didn't even mention Bob Bashira. And all that DNA evidence, she says, points in one direction, to Joe Gentz, not Bob.
Gentz did this all on his own, and then he made this story up.
And you know what? The forensic work really validates that story, doesn't it? It does you a lot of good, because forensically it says, yes, Gentz is doing there just exactly what he described, but we, the forensic techs, don't see much sign of Bob Bashira there.
Right. He was there as far as being a resident in the house. But what I'm saying, for that particular murder...
Not in the garage when the killing's going down, though.
There's no forensic evidence that puts him there at that particular time.
Aside from that lack of forensics, Diallo's overall strategy throughout the trial was to hammer home that her client's sexual behavior may have made for titillating headlines, but it didn't make Bob Becerra a murderer.
Let's get the elephant out of the room. All that BDSM, I'm going to tell you, in all my years of living, I had never, never heard of such things, right?
Was it relevant to the charges as you saw the case?
No. Let's talk about the homicide. Let's hit the facts. Let's hit the elements. Let's get the inconsistencies.
Diallo worked to poke holes in the prosecution's case, arguing Bob had no motive for murder, and that Jane knew about Bob's extracurricular activities.
There's no doubt in my mind that she knew what her husband was into, right?
Jane Becerra knew.
She knew.
About his kinky taste?
She knew. She was a lady, right, with a family. And her thing is, like so many women's things are, don't embarrass this family. You know, you just don't embarrass us, right?
Diallo put one of Jane's friends, Lois Valente, on the stand to illustrate the point.
Bob had gone to a key party over in Livonia or in Dearborn or somewhere over there, and he had wanted Jane to go with him.
And could you tell this jury what your understanding of key party was from Mrs. Bashar?
So I asked Jane, what's a key party? And she said, it's where everybody takes their keys, car keys, throws them into a bowl, and you take the key out, and you have sex with whoever you took whose keys you took out of the bowl.
The same friend also testified that Jane told Bob she didn't want to have anything to do with the key party and that he could do whatever he wanted to do without her.
Bob Becerra had been Bob Becerra for years. Do you understand me? This was nothing new. And something that people may not have known, Bob Becerra had been married before and divorced. So he knows how to divorce you without killing you.
The final pillar of Becerra's defense was a tried-and-true strategy. Discredit the investigation. Diallo argued that Grosse Pointe Park police were overwhelmed by this case and made a series of blunders. She called Detective Mike Narduzzi to the stand and pointed out this was his first homicide investigation.
This was huge, big news out of Grosse Pointe Park, the homicide of one of its residents, correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Nothing like this of this magnitude has ever happened under your watch, correct?
Correct.
The defense zeroed in on what it said were some key early mistakes made by the Grosse Pointe Park police. They noted officers didn't collect some of the victim's clothing for fiber evidence. They didn't pull the security camera footage outside the Hard Luck Lounge to see if Becerra was indeed there the night of the murder. And some of their early witness interviews were conducted improperly.
Does that lead you down the path of reasonable doubt in your arguments?
It can.
Prosecutors said the department's mistakes didn't prevent them from coming to the right conclusions. But Bob's defense argued that the errors accelerated the officer's rush to judgment that Bob Becerra was a murderer.
You're not investigating to get to, okay, what happened? Bob Becerra, he's our dude, so let's figure this out. And that's the way this investigation went.
In her closing, Diallo reiterated to the jury that her client's other life was no secret to his wife.
BDSM, that was not going to be a motive for murder in this case.
And she kept telling jurors that they never heard from the one person directly tying Bob Becerra to the murder of his wife, Joe Getz.
The defense, they just wanted to remind everybody that Bob himself, maybe he's a victim in all of this. Maybe Joe acted alone. And when you go back into that jury room, don't forget about that.
After nearly 2 months of testimony, Judge Evans sent jurors into that room to answer that one key question. Did Bob Becerra really turn his handyman into a hitman?
Coming up, could Master Bob control even the jury?
I think Bob, right into the very end, believed that he was going to get away with this.
And one more explosive twist.
So I get a letter. I'm like, what's going on?
It was December 2014, nearly 3 years after the murder of Jane Becerra. The trial of her husband Bob had exposed his secrets in suburban Grosse Pointe. Now, a jury would decide his fate.
It's in the hands of the jury now. I feel like any other attorney feels during a time like this. You don't know. It's up to a jury to decide.
How'd you feel about the case? Do you think you had it?
Yes, I did. And to me, it was a no-brainer. He did it. How could he not be found guilty?
After nearly three full days of deliberations, the jury gave its knock on the door.
We all got down there, and the courtroom was packed with interested people, the media, family, and you could hear a pin drop.
Homicide, murder, first degree, premeditated.
Guilty of homicide, murder, first degree, premeditated.
Guilty on all counts, including first degree murder.
At that moment, for me personally, I felt good for the family. I felt good for Jane's sisters and her mom, and I felt bad for Bob's family, but I mostly felt really satisfied by the work that the entire team did.
Hearing the verdict that he'd been found guilty, how did he take that?
I think he looked disgusted, right? You've got it wrong, you've got it wrong, right?
I think Bob, right into the very end, believed that he was going to get away with this, that there was a moment where he was going to be able to control this. Would Master Bob be able to control the courtroom, the jury, the judge? I mean, really, it's his final act of control. And is he going to get away with it? Well, he doesn't.
Judge Vonda Evans sentenced Bob Becerra to the mandatory life in prison.
Your desire to have Rachel was obsessive. You openly conducted a relationship with this woman around your family and friends.
Becerra remained defiant.
I am innocent that I had nothing to do with my wife's death. Terrible, terrible death.
And with that, it looked like the tragic and salacious saga of Bob Becerra was over. Until it wasn't. The news came to the judge's mailbox in December 2015, 1 year after Bob's conviction.
So I get a letter, and it's from Joe Gens. Okay. So my assistant reads it. She says, Judge, you got to read this. This is explosive.
It was an affidavit from Gens dictated to a fellow inmate. In it, Gens said he went to the Becerra home back in January 2012 on his own, angry that Bob hadn't paid him for some work. He continued, I knew Mr. Becerra was not in his house, so I broke into his home, walked into the garage, and Mrs. Jane Becerra caught me and I lost control. I could not longer live knowing that Mr. Robert Becerra was completely innocent. Robert Becerra was not even in his house when I killed his wife.
I'm like, am I going to have to retry this case? What's going on? I didn't know. I was on pins and needles.
Bob Becerra was already appealing his case, seeking a new trial. This could be a game changer.
And now Joe Gens is back in the spotlight, and he's saying he will tell his story.
Which in itself is another bombshell. I mean, now are we going to hear from Joe? And what story is Joe going to tell?
Judge Evans convened a special hearing.
And lo and behold, we bring Joe to court. And I tell him, do you understand? You've taken a plea agreement. And do you realize that the plea agreement was premised upon you being truthful? You lied. You're now facing some serious stuff.
I am not ready to proceed.
Bob sat in court expecting his one-time nemesis, Joe Gens, to bring him a new ticket to freedom, or at least a new trial. But Gens took the stand and did another 180, stunning the courtroom. He said he made up the version in that new affidavit, believing it would help him get less prison time.
What, this?
Yes.
This is garbage.
He went on to testify that Bob was in fact there in the garage with him. It was his original story, with some additional details.
Next thing I know, he pulls a gun on me and says, shut her up. They were arguing still. And he says, do it now. So I broke her neck. Yes, I'll be honest, I did do that. But meanwhile, after she was dead, he walks over, her top was open. He goes over to her and he says, I'm sorry, baby, I didn't mean it.
He didn't stumble. He was methodical in his explanation of what occurred. The truth gave Joe Gentz courage to be the master in that courtroom that day.
Do you believe all of Joe Gentz's story, some of it or most of it? What do you think?
I believe every single thing that he said. When Bob saw Joe, he didn't know what to think. But as the testimony began to unfold, he knew that Joe Gentz had his fate in his hand, and it was over.
Judge Evans denied Bob Becerra a new trial, and he later lost an appeal to the Michigan Supreme Court. In late 2016, the building that was once the Hard Luck Lounge and that dungeon burned to the ground. And then in August 2020, Bob Becerra, Big Bob, Master Bob, Inmate Bob, was taken to a hospital where he died. He was 62.
It seemed like it was never going to be over, and then it was over with a finality.
Yep, it's over. It's over. And I think the world's a little bit better off with him not in it, quite frankly.
It was a tough one to cover because you would get caught up in Bob and, you know, the alternate lifestyle and Joe, but then you would always come back to Jane, you know, justice for Jane.
Jane's free. She's free because Bob is gone. And so now she can rest and be the angel that she is.
That's all for this edition of Dateline. We'll see you again next Friday at 9, 8 Central. And of course, I'll see you each weeknight for NBC Nightly News. I'm Lester Holt for all of us at NBC News. Good night.